coming up on this episode of the Leadership Lounge.
Hire the best team. It's all about the people, right? I get the credit for what my company's done. And don't get me wrong, I've got some great ideas and I've taken a lot of risks. But the team around me, the leaders around me, are the reason that I look so good.
Welcome to Leadership Lounge. My name is Mitch Slater, Executive Director, UBS New York City, and I'm joined by my colleague, Saman Sami, First Vice President, Wealth Management from Dallas, Texas. And the best way to contact us is by emailing mitchslater@ubs.com or samansami@ubs.com. Our guest is not affiliated with UBS.
Welcome to Leadership Lounge. I'm Mitch Slater, alongside my co-host, Saman Sami. Our guest today is Rich Ballett, CEO of Vitra, the largest exclusive Verizon retailer in the country, with more than 1,500 stores across all 50 states. But Rich's story didn't begin in the boardroom. It started behind a DJ booth, where he learned the importance of reading a room, creating memorable experiences, and building relationships, lessons that would eventually help him lead one of the nation's most successful companies. In this conversation, Rich shares his entrepreneurial journey, his leadership philosophy, the value of coaching, how he thinks about hiring and culture, and why surrounding yourself with the best people may be the most important decision any leader can make.
Rich, thank you so much for joining the Leadership Lounge. I've gotten the pleasure to know you through CEO Coaching International and Mark Moses. But I'd love to start a podcast with this question. So every great entrepreneurial story has an origin. You started your first business as a teenager and launched what became Vitra while still in college. Just take us back and tell us what young Rich wanted to solve.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, my first business, I just needed to make some money. My father was unemployed and my job was to help contribute to the house. So I started DJing, first working for someone else and then broke out on my own as a mobile DJ. Yeah, so my first business as a mobile DJ was primarily started to get my help my parents out with some extra income. And then when I started the cell phone business, kind of the same story, you know, my father had some tough times moving from the north to the south, and he wasn't getting much luck getting a job in sales. And so I started the cell phone business for two reasons. One, I needed to get my father a job. And two, I thought the industry was primed to grow. I bought my first cell phone as a mobile DJ in Eastern North Carolina, getting lost with crazy directions. And so they saw how helpful they were. And so that's when we started the first cell phone store, was to get my father a job. And it worked out pretty well for the family.
You know, it's interesting you said that, Rich, because, you know, before you built one of the largest Verizon retailers in the country, you were behind a microphone as a DJ and radio. Now, I actually started that way, too, in D.C., working at every club in D.C. while I was in college. We our radio station broke the Clash. That was our big claim to fame, and had the opportunity to work at D.C. 101, kick-ass rock and roll, which was our slogan at the time. And I was there actually the day Howard Stern started. But anyway, looking back, what lessons from those early days in broadcasting, connecting with an audience, telling stories, reading the room, still show up in how you lead today?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a combination of that and just my background and heritage growing up with the family that I did. We were always people pleasers. We always entertained people. And so, you know, a guest experience is so important, particularly when you're in retail. And so carrying that ability to read guests over and train sales reps how to read guests to both increase sales, but most importantly, to improve that guest experience and make sure that guests are really being valued and that you're listening to what they say, right? People have all different ways of speaking, whether it's with their body language or their verbal skills or others. And oftentimes sales reps are not that great at that. And so if we can teach our team to pay attention to that body language and pay attention to what they actually say, usually you can solve a lot of problems that way and make a lot of happy guests. And it definitely comes back from my roots as a mobile DJ and a radio DJ as well.
What was your go-to kind of music?
You know, I didn't have a go-to kind of music. It was really simple. I just wanted to get people dancing when I did parties. When I worked in radio, obviously the program director picks the music. I did work in Top 40 when I was on the air. But as parties go, I didn't care if I was playing the Macarena, the Electric Slide, or YMCA. A lot of DJs hate those songs. If that's what it takes to get people dancing, I just want people to have a good time. And to this day, I still like having people have a good time, whether it's my business or somewhere else that I'm at.
You still DJ?
No, I don't DJ anymore. I've thought about getting back into it. Years ago, I did one wedding for a friend, probably 10 years ago, and I had 40 calls in the next week asking me if I would get back into the business to DJ their daughter's weddings.
It's a hard habit to break. I think you'll do it a few more times. It's a lot of fun, especially seeing people, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they hear that song that, I mean, you know, back in my day, if I played, you know, anything from the people that were in Northern Virginia that came into D.C. to hear Lynyrd Skynyrd, just like if I could play Sweet Home and Freebird.
I was going to say Freebird.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I know it.
Rich, tell us a little bit about Victra. You've gone through several cycles with it. You've built now a company that generates billions in revenue and operates in 50 states. Just tell us a little bit about the journey, because it's quite the story.
Yeah, look, we started with one store in Wilson, North Carolina, back in 1996. Here we are 30 years later. We have over 1,500 Verizon stores, close to 400 now Total Wireless stores, which is a prepaid brand under Verizon, in all 50 states. We're the largest Verizon retailer. I sold the company to private equity twice, and then I bought it back once. And so we're still the majority owners now. There's no private equity money involved in the business. Just me and a few partners, and we're having a blast and continue to run it every day. And, you know, I'm blessed with an amazing team of employees. I've had some with me as long as 29 out of 30 years. So that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And we continue to grow every day. In my opinion, if you're either green and growing or ripe and rotting, and I prefer to be green and growing. So we're going to continue to grow this business as long as we can and develop a lot of amazing leaders to continue on to the next generation.
Tell me about that private equity sale, because a lot of owners, they just want to be done. What made you want to come back?
Well, I don't know if I wanted to come back. Okay. The private equity guys, the second time around, great group of guys, Lone Star, had two different CEOs working for them that did not perform as well as they liked. And for various reasons, they parted ways with them. And so I was asked to come in kind of as a bridge CEO until they could go out and do a new search. And then the results started really performing well. So they said, hey, Rich, you're doing pretty good. Why don't you stay? And so I said, okay, fine. Running the company was always a love of mine and a passion. And, you know, I took 4 years off, which were 4 years that I really spent a lot of time with my children at a perfect age. But then they started getting into high school and driver's licenses, and I became less important. And so going back to work gave me something to look forward to every day as well. I think a lot of CEOs who sell their business find a big gaping wide hole of what do I do with all my time? And retiring at 37, which is what I tried to do the first time, was way too young. I could only go fishing with 80-year-old guys talking about prostates so many times a week.
Yeah.
Before it got old.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so going back was actually quite exciting for me, and I really enjoyed it. And we were able to grow it massively. And so since we bought the company back, you know, we acquired other locations similar to ours and grown the company by more than 50% since I bought it back in 2021 now, and continue to enjoy running it every day.
I got to dig into this question real quick. So both you and I know Mark Moses really well at CEO Coaching International. Tell me about the importance of having a coach. And I find your story fascinating when I hear you guys speak about it. You guys have almost become like brothers, and you've gone through this this whole cycle together. Talk to me about having a coach.
You know, it always amazes me when you talk about coaches in the CEO capacity. A lot of people are like, what, you have a coach? Why would you have a coach? But if I said I'm a professional athlete and I have a coach, they go, right. Of course you have a coach, right? So
yeah.
So it's idiotic for me to think that people wouldn't have a coach as a CEO. Once you get above about $1 million a year in revenue, you really need a coach because they hold you accountable to yourself, right? So there was a time when I was so focused on trying to get this one store open in the Outer Banks of North Carolina where the city was being difficult. And it would have made like $50,000 more profit for the year, and went to Mark about it. Mark's like, well, Rich, he's like, before we talk about that, how are you coming on this other multi-million dollar project? And I go, oh, you mean the one I haven't started because I'm too busy worrying about $50,000? And he goes, yeah. And I go, okay, understood. And I stop worrying about the $50,000 multi-million dollar. Yep. And the difference is sometimes as leaders, you know, we get tied up in the day-to-day emotion, right? It's super easy to do. And so a coach holds you accountable to yourself more than anything else. But then they also teach you an operating system, and they have, you know, tons of contacts and experience that kind of been there, done that. When I left the business, my replacement CEO stopped using CEO coaching. When I came back, we started using them again. And I'm going to say it's partially directly related, right? That's part of the reason that the company's done so much better since I came back is because I brought back in the operating system that Mark taught me and Mark's, you know, wisdom as well. And I could go through lots of details about that. But if you're an entrepreneur and you don't have a coach, you need to get one. That's just not that smart. And then on top of that, yeah, Mark and I are like brothers these days. He's been there with me through the hardest times, selling through private equity. He was on vacation and, you know, I interrupted his vacation nonstop, but he was there for me kind of 24/7 as needed to help guide me through that stressful process. You know, I remember my wife came to me the night before I sold the first time and said, Rich, you're stressed out to the max. I just don't think you should do this. And I said, honey, you don't sell a business for nine figures without some stress. You know, that's normal. And it's going to be okay, you know, and I only felt that way because I had Mark to lean on, who kept telling me it's going to be okay. And I'll tell you, after having Mark as a coach and running through the process, I don't think there's a company out there today that I couldn't run, because the leadership skills, the operational methodology that I've been taught, they transfer from company to company. It's not just wireless. It's every business is people and the same thing, you know. It's only two ways to make money: increase revenue and decrease expense. And I can do that at any business.
Yeah, so, coaching is everything. And, you know, I had the opportunity to interview Jay Wright not that long ago from the Villanova coach. And as we talked about earlier, I'm a big New York Knicks fan, and hopefully they'll close things out this week. But basically, the starting five is all Villanova players. And the leadership that Jay Wright taught these young men, Jalen Brunson, for example, you know, really shows today. And I had a coach throughout my career, and I was fortunate enough to work with YPO through my brother-in-law, who was very involved and ran the chapter here in New Jersey. So a tremendous organization, and obviously everything Mark's done with CEO coaching just shows that. One of the things that also I hear all the time, and I had the opportunity to, I'm friends with a guy named Gary Vaynerchuk. I'm sure you're familiar with Gary V. And Gary just, you know, he's all over the place, but there's a lot there in the meat of understanding what you learn from the times that you struggle. And, you know, you've talked openly about that. You even, you know, even faced the possibility of bankruptcy. So what do those difficult seasons, so to speak, teach you about leadership that success never could?
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, you know, I think the most successful CEOs all have a story about where they stumbled and fell. And it's how you brush yourself off and get back up and keep going forward that makes all the difference, right? The difference between the CEOs who push through that and don't is nothing more than that simple fact. They push through it, right? You have that attitude of, I'm never going to give up. I'm going to figure this out, and I will give everything trying until I do. And I think that's so important. And then, of course, with that comes making sure you have the right leaders around you. You know, part of my biggest fall and stumble that time was I didn't have the right leadership team, particularly CFO, around me. And that's when I did hire Mark Moses and brought on Mark as a coach. Was after my big stumble, and you know, never looked back since then. Don't get me wrong, we've had some tough challenges, but now I know how to handle them in a better way. And I have the team around me to help me handle them in a better way. So if you're not doing well as a leader and you're facing a tough obstacle, one, don't give up. And two, get a coach or some other peer advisors to help you. And then three, make sure you have the right team around you. That's probably where you're failing, is you don't have the right people to help navigate you through the disaster.
Hey, as entrepreneurs scale, they often recognize that team A that got them to point B is not the same team that's going to get them to C. Talk a little bit about that, because I know you've had experience.
Look, that's one of the hardest things for young entrepreneurs to figure out, is that the people who get you from A to B can't always get you from B to C, and you have to upsize your team as the continued growth of the company. I had one guy particularly ran sales for me who was my best friend, but we outgrew him, and I was able to remove him from that role and put him in a role that he's been more successful at, and he's still, I'm fortunate to say, works with us today. But there's a lot of people who just don't make that decision soon enough to remove someone from the company and help them with a soft landing. So respect your employees, try and find something else that fits either in your company or outside. And I've had tons of people come to me years later and say, I hated you when you fired me, but I now see that was the best move for both of us. And I've landed in a place where I could blossom and be successful. And I see your company did as well. Thank you so much. But at the time, it's really stressful. But getting the right people, I think that is the number one secret to growing a really large business. Is as you continue to grow, is getting the right team to help you grow.
Let me ask you real quick, because firing someone's not easy, okay? And I'm sure you remember the very first time you did it. So is that something that you had to get coached on? I'm going to dig into the coaching here a little bit again.
Look,
it would be hard for me to do it. And so I just have to ask.
Yeah, in the beginning, firing is never fun for anybody. Anybody who says it's fun, there's something wrong with them.
Right.
And so even to this day, I hate firing people. And so, look, firing, you know, in the beginning, I used to take a long time to fire them, and I'd beat around the bush and I'd talk forever and kind of get there. And, you know, now if I let somebody go now, I'm in and out in 30 seconds. I mean, it's super fast, because, by the way, as soon as you let them go, they don't hear anything anyway. So you're better off to say HR is going to follow up with you and give you all the details, you know, 24 to 48 hours. But I'm letting you go. But terminating someone is not fun. And yeah, it sucked in the beginning. And I was coached years later by some really great HR people on how to get in, get out, and just be quick about it. Because at the end of the day, it's like ripping off a Band-Aid, right? It's going to hurt a lot more if you do it nice and slow. Doing it fast, it still hurts, but it doesn't hurt quite as much. And it all comes down to the follow through afterwards, right? So if you have a really good HR team, they're going to help that person with a severance package and understand the benefits for transition and things of that nature. But yeah, firing people, Sammy, is never a fun time. No. And anybody who says otherwise, they have some mental health issues.
it's never easy. So, you know, it's also not that easy making a lot of acquisitions and navigating, you know, the collaboration and consolidation in the industry. So when you're evaluating opportunities, and you've been involved in so many of these, what separates a great acquisition from a costly distraction?
Great question. So for us, you know, the acquisitions we've done is primarily a roll-up strategy. So we're looking at businesses that are very similar to ours that we could, you know, mold into our company and get some huge synergies right away. So we have multiple kinds of synergies we look at, you know, cost-cutting synergies, sales synergies, buying synergies, things like that. And so first, we're going to make sure the financial model makes sense and that we can make 1 + 1 = 3. And we've been really good about doing that. Two, we're going to make sure that the culture fits. And if the culture doesn't fit, we're going to plan for extra leadership for that transition to make sure that we can help overcome the cultural differences. I would say when I was gone and we did some other acquisitions, the culture was the main reason things didn't work out so well, because the CEOs at the time didn't know how to bridge that culture gap. And so, you know, but making sure you get the culture right, making sure you have the math right. And then look, as far as making sure it's not a distraction, you got to make sure you're staying inside your core focus. I think all too often people will do acquisitions that are horizontal instead of vertical, or even some vertical, outside of their industry, and go either horizontally or vertically, and get out of areas that they're experts at and not hire experts. It's okay to stretch into new territories, but you either have to have somebody on your team that's an expert in that or bring somebody in. It's when you get outside your expertise, I think, that you run into a lot of problems. Fortunately, we have not done that. But we did step outside of the bounds a little bit, not necessarily for acquisitions, but for some organic opportunities in different sub-businesses with Verizon that didn't work out well for us. And we had to assess that pretty quickly and pull back out. But I think as long as you have the right experts leading it, you're going to be just fine.
You know, I want to ask you about culture, but I want to tie it in a little bit to the retail side. For someone who spent a lot of time in Verizon stores over the years, it's extremely important, especially in the early days of cell phones. When people, you know, really weren't used to their iPhone or used to whatever they're using. And, you know, you're really relying on these people for help. So, you know, as organizations get larger, culture sometimes can get diluted. So how have you worked to preserve your own entrepreneurial DNA, you know, while leading thousands of employees like that?
Yeah, it's challenging. There's no doubt, right? I'd love to tell you that the people coming on today get the same cultural experience as when I first started the company 30 years ago, but that's just not the truth. And so look, there's a few things we do. So I'm very big on open door policy. So like this afternoon, I have 3 town halls scheduled for 3 1-hour town halls for different groups of people. And I do digital town halls with my entire company, trying to do them at least every quarter, if not every 6 months, to get their feedback. And it's straight to me. It's not filtered. There's no turn your questions in advance that I pick the random questions that I like. It's live. Ask a question and I'll answer it. If I don't know the answer to that question, I'll say, that's a great question. Let me follow up and get back to you. And every question gets answered, whether it's live or followed up and shared with the entire company. And that's one way we keep the culture that I started, is showing them that we're going to be transparent with them as much as we can. There's times we have NDA signs and things like that that we can't tell them everything. But if we can tell them, we're going to always tell them the reason why. And I think why is one of the most important words when it comes to culture that's ignored. It's okay to ask someone to do something. It's even better, though, if you can ask them to do it and tell them why you need them to do it and tie that back. And look, the entrepreneurial spirit, it's in me deep. And I hire people from corporate America, and sometimes I have to beat them up and beat them up hard to get away from some of these corporate things. Like, God forbid you tell somebody you want to start something on a day other than the 1st or the 15th. They look at you like you're crazy, because in corporate America, everything magically starts on the 1st or the 15th. I haven't figured out what's so special about those numbers. I'm sure there's a reason, but for some reason, that's when, you know, and so, but you got to get corporate people out of that mindset and ask, just because you've always done it that way, is it the right way to do it? And teaching people things like that. But I would say when it comes to culture, I describe it as like going bowling with kids, right? When you go bowling with kids, you put the little bumpers up on the side and that keeps the ball in the lane. That's all I can do these days. I keep the ball in the lane and kind of bounce the culture where I want it to be to keep it down that center alley. How I pay people, how I give them time off, what my handbook says, how I treat people, how I do town halls. All these little things are parts of culture that guides them down the alleyway. Again, I can't hand Sammy a piece of paper that lists my culture and say, Sammy, here's the culture. You will do exactly this or you're fired.
Mm-hmm.
That just doesn't work, right? That's a different kind of culture. Nobody's going to want to work in a culture of fear. And so we do the bumper kind of style, and sometimes we do great at it and you can feel it in the company. And sometimes you don't. By the way, I do quarterly planning events with my coach, Mark. And one of the questions we ask is, on a scale of 1 to 10, rate the culture of the business. And we track that over time. And you'd be amazed at my leadership team. These are the top 10, 20 people in the business that are in this meeting, how their numbers will fluctuate as the whole team fluctuates based on how well we're doing, how poor we're doing, problems we've encountered, all the different normal course of business will impact that culture score. And that's just one of like 4 or 5 metrics that we track. But you can put a number on culture and grade yourself and figure out how well you're doing.
Yeah, as we talk today, the world obviously is changing dramatically. I heard you recently, I know you're a big fisherman, and you know, you were talking about how amazing it is with satellite. You can just get anything done from, you know, out in the middle of any ocean, lake or creek or anywhere you want. But, you know, I've got to ask the AI question as well, because how, as a leader, are you using AI in a positive way? And what are some of your concerns being in the cell phone business, basically, with everything that's changing and also with everything that Musk is bringing to the table, especially through SpaceX and everything else that's happening in that world?
Yeah, two big questions there. Look, when it comes to AI, I'm super excited about AI. I think AI is a wonderful thing. I think it can make my teams much more efficient and effective. And we're leaning in heavily into AI with the goal of not to reduce headcount, but to make ourselves bigger and better and continue that growth with less future headcount, right? So instead of having to add more people, I won't have to. So giving it so someone like Sammy can do 4 times the amount of work, and not have to, you know, stress out too much and work 7 days a week, like I know Sammy sure does. You know, so
yes,
as far as that goes, we're leveraging AI to make our teams more effective and more efficient. And look, there will be some attrition over time naturally, and maybe we don't backfill as many roles potentially as well. That's to be determined and to be seen. Obviously, AI continues to grow so fast. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. I'm a little scared on AI too, right? When you look at things like Mythos, with the ability to hack in almost any website, you know, cybersecurity becomes more concerning for entrepreneurs as well, especially the smaller entrepreneurs who don't have the resources that we might to be able to build up that cybersecurity team. But I do believe that it's not a matter of if you're going to get hacked, it's a matter of when these days with AI coming out. And there's just so many new things coming on AI to be determined. When it comes to SpaceX and their aspirations for, you know, Starlink being a cell phone provider, look, I'm not as scared as others on this one. I do think Elon Musk has an impressive history of being successful. And so I do think he'll figure out a way to get into the industry. However, technology at this time doesn't allow very good in-building penetration. You got to have line of sight. That's also impacted by things like clouds and things like that. And look, right now, there's a lot of people in the United States that would love to have better coverage, and they're only 5-10 miles from a cell phone tower. Those satellites are, you know, 100 miles up in the sky,
mm-hmm. or more. Me included.
Yeah, or more. And so, you know, you kind of wonder how strong the satellite signal is going to be. But technology continues to get better and better every day. So I'm not a fool. I'm not going to sit here and say I don't have to worry about Elon Musk or other satellite providers. I do think there will be a time when they solve that those technological hurdles and become a real competitor. That being said, I feel very good that Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile on the ground have such a huge advantage and built out networks. And just when you look at bandwidth and speeds and things and how fast they are, coverage, all of those things together, I think the carriers are going to be around for a long, long time. I see it more as a joint, you know, partnership down the road to fill in the blanks or maybe make it easier to travel around the world as opposed to your primary cell provider. I think T-Mobile, AT&T, and Verizon, mostly Verizon, of course, are going to win the war. They're going to win the war when it comes to satellite telephones.
I agree.
Well, you struck me as someone that's so competitive, so I have no doubt that you'll figure it out. But
And by the way, he's got to figure out how to sell it too, right? At the end of the day, he needs people like us, right? We're retail salespeople. There's not any Starlink stores, and he's done well with the sales of Starlink so far. But it's a product that when you put a Starlink in your house, it doesn't move, right? The box isn't being moved around, carried with you all the time, so you don't have that repetitive nature of dropping a cell phone. So if he does get into that space, he's going to have to figure out distribution strategy as well.
Good point.
I think we've got a heck of an advantage on that as well. So, but he's got a lot of money. I mean, richest guy in the world. So you can build
he
a
definitely
network.
Definitely does.
Yeah.
I gotta shift the conversation a little bit more personal. So like you've achieved tremendous success, honestly, on paper and also but in life. Your husband, your father of four, you're active in the community, you care about charity. Like, talk about intentionality, how you wanted to design this life, or did, I'm sure some of it just kind of happened, but as it progressed, you've been very intentional about this that you should be proud of. I just like to tap into that a little bit.
Thank you. Yeah, look, it's definitely been a challenge to maintain the balance between work and family and all those things. And time is the one resource that they don't make any more of, right? I can't go out and say, let me buy another 20 years. Although with longevity stuff, I do think that is coming to some extent, you know, especially if you listen to Peter Diamandis and others.
Yes.
But time at 24 hours in a day isn't, I don't think Peter's figured out a way to change that. And so, you know, I'm very intentional about how I schedule my time with work and with family. And so, and also for myself, right? I have to have time to go to the gym, to decompress. One of the things I find most CEOs do a really bad job of is having enough time to think themselves. They will schedule their day full and not give a gap of time to actually do your job, which is to think and figure out the future. And not just making decisions and answering meeting questions. And so look, working that balance out has been tricky as I've gotten a better and better team and with better coaching. There's only five jobs a CEO is supposed to do, according to Mark Moses, and anything else you shed to other people on your team. And I've done a much better job of that over the last 10 years than I did the prior 20. And in doing so, I've made time for my wife and for my kids. And then I do a lot of other things as well. So I'm on a university board. I'm the president of a high school. My wife runs a nonprofit charity that we're very passionate about that helps women in addiction. And, you know, there's so much time in the world that so much opportunity in the world to do things, but I'm restricted in time. And so I have to really pick out what's most important, which also means I have to set a lot of boundaries and say no a lot more, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who would love for me to be on their board. People ask me to coach them all the time. People ask for advice, and I do my best to help people, but I can't commit to coaching on a long-term basis. I just don't have the time for it, and that's not my job. And I do the best I can where I can. But right now, I keep the priorities right. My family comes first. They might not always think that, but the family comes first, and I get to decide whether it's more important to, you know, go watch my daughter's dance recital or go to solve a problem at work, right? She might think it's the most important thing in the world, and it might be at that time. But sometimes there's other problems that happen. And one good thing has happened. My wife running a nonprofit, it's still a business. And now she sees the interruptions of life that happen with businesses and challenges. So she understands even more now how I've stepped away for the years and done what I've had to do. But look, it's a challenge. Time management is a skill that CEOs need to master. And it's really hard to do. And I have a really good assistant, Nicole. You probably worked with her on scheduling this call.
I got to give her a shout out. She's a superstar.
She's been with me for over a decade. She's awesome. And she controls my calendar. If my mom wants to go to lunch with me, she reaches out to my assistant to schedule lunch because otherwise it's not going to happen.
Let me dive into that a little bit. An executive assistant can be key for a CEO. When did you realize you needed one?
Jack Daly said to me many years ago, if you don't have an assistant, you are one.
Yes.
And that sunk pretty deep at the time. And so I've had one for over 20 years now. And it's one of those things as you start to grow, particularly when your schedule starts to get challenging and when you realize, more than 10 or 20% of your workload is tasks, you know, print this, copy this, fill this out. Hiring someone who is going to be less expensive than yourself on a per hour basis makes the most sense. It's no different than my wife and I, we first got married. And my wife said, look, in my family, my dad took care of the outside of the house and my mom took care of the inside. And I said, okay, deal. She called me the next week and she goes, Rich, there's some guys outside mowing the grass. And I said, yeah. She goes, I thought you were going to take care of that. I said, who do you think hired them? You know, and so it's the same thing. So, in business, you gotta offload some of those easier tasks. I shouldn't say easier, but more time consuming and less strategic tasks, more tactical. If you can offload them to an assistant, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Before I handle our final question that we do, I just take a second because I heard you talk a little bit before about your wife's nonprofit, and I'd love to give you the opportunity to talk about that for a moment because she's doing really, really important work.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, so she runs Haven at Blue Creek, which you can visit at havenatbluecreek.com, and it's an inpatient drugs and alcohol treatment facility for women in addiction. It's completely free. She doesn't charge anything for it. It's all funded through donations from my family and from a lot of other generous families and people out there. We kind of match every donation that comes in, two for one. And so she does it for free to make it so those folks can get the treatment that they need. And she's got hundreds of people now that I think are sober as a direct result of her efforts over the last 3 or 4 years. And she continues to do it every day. It's hard work, but I respect her immensely for what she does there. And she's really helping save some families. My wife is an addict. She's in recovery now. She's sober going on 8 years, and it's changed our life. And we're just trying to share that with others, because if you don't know an addict, you'll be the first person I meet that doesn't know one. Everybody knows someone who's either an alcoholic or an addict, and you probably have one in your mind right now. And that's what my wife does, is help them get sober, particularly for women, which is even harder because a lot of these facilities are male focused, and it's really tough for women to get the safe environment that they need. Hence the Haven part of Haven at Blue Creek.
No, and I have a family member, a young woman in her 40s who fortunately got help like that exactly, and it life-changing, and she's going on sober now 6 or 7 years, and it's made a tremendous difference. So kudos to your wife, and we're certainly going to put up a link about that because we want to be able to help people. So we always close our Leadership Lounge with the billboard question, but in all fairness, I got to give credit to Tim Ferriss because he did write an entire book called Tribe of Mentors, where he asked this question, but I was so blown away with it that I just borrowed it from Tim with his permission to end the podcast. So imagine you could place a billboard on the busiest highway in America. Every entrepreneur, CEO, future leader would see it. Rich, what's the message you'd put on that billboard and why?
Hire the best team. It's all about the people, right? I get the credit for what my company's done. And don't get me wrong, I've got some great ideas and I've taken a lot of risks. But the team around me, the leaders around me, are the reason that I look so good. And I need all the help I can get, as you can see. You know, you're looking at me on camera here. So they make me look good, right? I mean, the stuff that I've accomplished is because I have a great team. And, you know, there's 5 things that a CEO is supposed to do. I mentioned earlier, hiring the best team is one of them. The people who report directly to me and one below are the ones that I interview. And getting the right team and stretching yourself and maybe hiring somebody a little bit more expensive than you can afford will always pay for itself, in my experience. If you get the right people, the right leaders, everything else falls into place.
Rich, thank you so much for joining us. I think our audience is going to take away a lot from your journey, from the importance of coaching and intentional leadership to building great teams and never losing that entrepreneurial mindset. And thanks to all of you for listening to Leadership Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, share it with a colleague, and join us next time for another conversation with leaders who are making an impact.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.